Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. U.S. military officials say they've launched another major combat operation in northwest Iraq near the Syrian border. Operation Spear involves 1,000 U.S. Marines, sailors, and Iraqi soldiers. 11 Marines, 2 sailors, and 21 Iraqis have died in that region in the past week. Also today, two new polls from the New York Times and CBS and the Wall Street Journal show public approval of President Bush's handling of the war and domestic issues is in steep decline. Well, there is some progress on the political front in Iraq. For more on that and other developments at week's end, we're joined by the Los Angeles Times Baghdad Bureau Chief Patrick McDonnell. And Patrick, Sunni and Shiite politicians have been haggling over the makeup of the committee that will draft a new constitution. The Sunnis have now accepted an offer from the Shiites for 13 or 15 seats on the committee plus 10 advisor positions. So has the logjam been broken?
I think it's a break in the logjam, but there may well be other logjams in the future. And remember, we haven't started even discussing substantive issues of the Constitution yet. This is something like the Paris peace talks in Vietnam years ago when they were talking about the shape of the table.
In other news, U.S. officials say they've captured a top lieutenant of Abu Musab Zarqawi, who heads the insurgency known as al-Qaeda in Iraq. The captured man's name is Mohammed Sharkawa. He's said to be responsible for at least 50 car bombings and 150 beheadings and assassinations, heading up several hundred insurgents. How important is this?
This is considered a very significant capture indeed. Abu Talha, as he was known, was supposedly Zarqawi's top lieutenant in Mosul, which is up in northern Iraq and has been a center of the insurgency. The question here is that there have been many, many top lieutenants, or supposed top lieutenants, of Zarqawi and his organization taken into custody in recent weeks and months. Many of these arrests have been touted as breakthroughs, and yet we've really seen no cessation in the violence. On the contrary, the violence seems to increase. So it remains to be seen whether this arrest will translate into a reduction in violence. The way the insurgency and Zarqawi's network in particular seem to work is they're very, very cellular in nature. And when these big arrests have been made by the Americans or the Iraqis, the other cells continue to operate.
Well, there's other news from within the ranks of U.S. soldiers. An Army National Guard sergeant has been charged in the deaths of two other soldiers. What is he alleged to have done?
Yeah, this is the case of an Army Master Sergeant who was based in Tikrit, Staff Sergeant Alberto Martinez. And what he's alleged to have done is killed his commanding officer and another higher-ranking officer at the base in Tikrit, using some type of explosives, possibly grenades or some other kind of explosives. Details are still rather vague on this. To my knowledge, it's the first alleged fragging incident we've had in Iraq, and the whole notion of fragging, of a staff sergeant killing his superior officer, has a lot of overtones of some of the things that happened in Vietnam, and it has the American command structure here in Iraq very, very concerned, this particular incident.
Well, and on the other hand, there's the story of Sergeant Leanne Hester, the first female in 60 years to receive a Silver Star.
Yeah, Sergeant Hester was also with the National Guard, even out of Kentucky, I believe, and they were guarding a convoy southeast of Baghdad a few months back when they came under very intense coordinated insurgent fire and essentially beat back the insurgents. What's interesting about this is that while there are not women in infantry units in the military, the way the war is going, just being on convoy duty can be extremely dangerous and can put anyone in the middle of combat, be they women or men. And this woman, the Army says, acted very bravely during a very difficult attack in which I think more than 24 insurgents were said to have been killed, and certainly 3 Army soldiers were seriously wounded.
She reportedly dove into a ditch, fired at and killed insurgents, lobbed grenades, and saved, is credited with saving many of her fellow soldiers. And this as Congress is debating proposals to limit women's positions in combat zones. From your vantage point, that doesn't seem possible, as you've just said.
Right. I think one of the things we're seeing here, and even many of the male officers agree, is that the lines of what exactly is combat and isn't combat in Iraq are becoming blurred because of the nature of the conflict. There are many women in the military who are, for instance, serving as truck drivers, which happens to be one of the most dangerous things you can do, so it's hard really to even define that as a non-combat mission now. So there are many, many women who are involved in combat, even though they're not in infantry units.
Patrick McDonald, Baghdad Bureau Chief for the LA Times. Patrick, thank you.
You're welcome.
The city of Detroit is celebrating after the Pistons crushed the San Antonio Spurs in Game 4 of the NBA Finals last night, tying the series at 2 games apiece. The city had once hoped this major sporting event at the state-of-the-art Palace Stadium in Auburn Hills would give Detroit a chance to shine on the world stage, but the Pistons seemed to be the only bright spot in an otherwise dim landscape. Enormous budget deficits, a failing auto industry, and dozens of schools closing their doors. What's going on in Detroit, and what are the ramifications for the rest of the country? Well, joining us now, Tom Walsh, columnist for the Detroit Free Press. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, Robin.
And we welcome back Nolan Finley, editorial page editor for the Detroit News. Welcome, Nolan.
Hey, Robin.
And Tom, let's start with you. You make the point in a column that I was reading that the city made some of the same mistakes that General Motors did. What are they?
Well, they got fat, dumb, and happy. We had the last gold rush here in Detroit where people without a lot of education and a lot of skills could come and make a lot of money and have the best health care and pension benefits in the United States. And that existed for a couple of generations of people in the factories, and then the city governments awarded people the same kind of benefits. And that was great when those big companies and big institutions could deliver the goods. But today they're not delivering the goods, and it's all threatened.
And Tom, before we move on, how much has the population changed?
Well, I mean, the population is half what it was. It was about 2 million early 1960s, and it's about 900 to 950,000 now.
Last week, General Motors announced plans to slash 25,000 jobs nationwide. How much of an impact is the auto industry having on what's happening in the city? Nolan?
Well, considerable, happening in the city and happening in the state. But the thing you have to look at is the auto industry has been cyclical over the decades. Detroit's decline has not been cyclical. Detroit has been, the city itself, has been in a 30-year or more steadily declining state. Things get worse year after year after year, and there's been no uptick. What you're seeing now is that automotive problems, the problems with the core city, are starting to affect the region, which has always been fairly prosperous, as well as the state as a whole. And I think that's why you have a lot more worry here and, quite frankly, some panic.
When we hear about Detroit having problems, there's a little bit of a feel of 'twas ever thus.
Absolutely.
And especially with the population decline, we have heard about urban flight. It has been also called white flight in the past. Why is it continuing, especially when, as Tom just said, there were times when there was a gold rush for the auto industry?
Yeah, those times are long gone, but this isn't white flight anymore. The white population of the city left long ago. The city's almost 90% or 80-some percent African-American. What you're seeing now is the African-American middle class leaving the city, and that's a very, very dangerous thing because they take with them the leadership, they take with them the tax base. The upper class has already left, and what you're going to be faced with soon is a one-class, one-race city with all of the social problems that come with that and very few resources to pay for it.
And to add to that, Nolan, as you write, this month 50 Detroit public and Catholic schools will close their doors for good. They have a $200 million budget shortfall. The school closings cannot have a good impact on the neighborhoods and the character of the city.
Well, the neighborhoods of the city, when we talk about Detroit, we tend to focus on downtown. But if you get out and drive through these neighborhoods, I would say you'll find more devastation than you'll find anywhere in Iraq.
Really?
Absolutely. There are blocks. That's not to say there aren't nice neighborhoods in Detroit. There are still some left. But there's no place you can stand in a Detroit neighborhood and not be within walking distance of blight.
Tom, what's wrong? What's happened? What hasn't happened?
Well, what's happened in Detroit is what's happened on some scale in most major cities. One of the real difficulties now with the budget crisis is that Detroit's city fathers, city council and the mayor, never reduced the size of government comparable to the size of the population decline. So you've still got this bloated government with a much smaller population.
Nolan Finley, you recently wrote, Fort Shelby vultures will feast if Detroit's leaders keep making destructive choices. What does that sentence mean?
Well, I'm looking out my window now at a hotel, and this is in the heart of downtown Detroit. It's a large hotel, fills a whole city block. It has been vacant since the day I walked in the door here. Mm-hmm. Windows all broke out, and now on top of it, we have a family or a flock of vultures, turkey vultures, buzzards, roosting. And I thought it was very mm-hmm. good metaphor for what's going on here.
Well, let's talk about the current mayor and the city council. Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick and the city council seem to have been at war for the last 3 months. One of the main issues, how to handle a $300 million budget gap. It's threatened thousands of city jobs. And now even the summer fireworks display, has it been canceled?
No, now it's back on again, and of course a lot of people accuse the mayor of grandstanding and threatening to cancel the fireworks in sort of an act of petulance after the council overrode his veto of the council's budget, which will result in bigger cuts in the police department, and the mayor, you know, if you won't give us enough cops, we won't put on the fireworks. Well, you know, if he thought that would resound politically in his favor, he was wrong.
As we speak, I'm getting more and more depressed. And
Us too.
I'm just wondering, how are the people in Detroit responding to all of this?
Well, people have always been concerned, but there's always been a level of optimism.
And to touch on that, you have the Detroit Pistons in the NBA Finals, and you have the All-Star Game. I mean, the thinking was great.
The Super Bowl.
And they got the Super Bowl in 2006, right? So, you know, I understand the thinking was, great, we're going to shine.
There's a dismay here that I haven't seen in my 30 years almost in this town. And it's, you know, it comes from the fact that people don't seem to know what to do next, how to pull this up and out. And that's not just for the city. That's at the state level, too.
You're right, Nolan. There is this dismay. And I think it's also a kind of a profound disappointment. When Kilpatrick came into office, I mean, he's a young guy. He's a fabulous public speaker. He is, you know, a person that people thought, okay, he's green, but he's a guy of great potential. He's a great salesman. If he's out selling the city, you know, to the NCAA Basketball Committee, that's another event that's coming to Detroit. People saw potential there that has gone unrealized or, you know, disappointed people. They thought, okay, well, here was a shot. And then we had some great investments in the city. General Motors led, along with the Kresge Foundation, a huge mm-hmm. investment in the riverfront area to reclaim some of the old industrial land and turn it into parkland and public use. And that was a big upper. But now we have General Motors sort of careening toward whatever's going to happen to them with their junk bond rating now. And so people are thinking all of that is at risk, all of the leadership and investment GM has put downtown. Mm-hmm. So I think the kind of double whammy of what's happened to GM in the auto industry, plus the disappointment of the Kilpatrick administration, really has sort of people, you know, wondering what's next.
Well, that's Tom Walsh of the Detroit Free Press. We've also been speaking with Nolan Finley of the Detroit News about Detroit. Well, when we come back, we will also hear from one of Mayor Kilpatrick's biggest critics, an investigative reporter whose on-air sparring with the mayor has turned into a video war. Stay with us. There's much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Detroit is facing dilapidated neighborhoods, a serious city budget crunch, school closings, and urban flight. So today we've been doing the anatomy of an American city with Nolan Finley, editorial page editor for the Detroit News, and Tom Walsh, columnist for the Detroit Free Press. And Tom, what do you think can be done to revive Detroit?
Oh, boy. If I had that answer, I think, you know, number one, these auto companies have to get stabilized. There's no way. I mean, if General Motors or Ford Motor Company go down the tubes, this place, not only the city but the region, are going to have a long, long haul ahead of them economically. So these These companies have got to stabilize. They've got to get structured realistically for the kind of volume that they're doing now, and they're taking some steps in that direction. Politically, the city needs to put some people in office who will inspire some confidence and trust, and it's not going to happen overnight.
And Nolan Findlay, you've been talking about how this ripples out from the city. Tell us more. How do the problems of Detroit ripple out to Michigan and then to the country?
Well, it's just like the conversation we're having when you talked about in your intro what's happening around the Palace. Well, the Palace is actually in Oakland County, one of the more prosperous communities in the nation. But when people think of Detroit, they think of the whole region. So Oakland County, Macomb County, Western Wayne County all get tarred with that negative brush. It makes it harder to bring investment here, and it makes it harder to bring residents here or to keep our young people here. And we have a tremendous drain of our young people going to other more exciting and prosperous places.
People who are still there love Detroit. Remind us, what is to love about Detroit, Tom?
Well, there's lots to love about Detroit and Michigan. There's all kinds of inland lakes. You've got the Great Lakes. Quality of life, you've got wonderful seasons, if you like the seasons. Up north, northern Michigan is still relatively unspoiled and beautiful, and it's a wonderful place to live and raise a family, and for a journalist, it's a great news town.
There's that. Nolan, any silver lining in this?
I don't see any silver lining at all ahead. If the economy soared tomorrow and things turned around here, Detroit would still be in trouble. It has to, as Tom said, accept political leadership that is willing to make tough choices, willing to fix the schools, willing to improve services and cut the tax base to stop that 1,000-person-a-month population drain, and then begin slowly reviving and solving its problems. But I don't see that political leadership anywhere on the horizon.
Well, the Pistons could win.
Pistons could win.
That could happen. There you have
it. Win.
Tom Walsh, columnist for the Detroit Free Press. Nolan Findlay, editorial page editor for the Detroit News. Thank you both.
Thank you,
Robin.
Well, the Detroit newspapers aren't the only ones taking aim at the city's political leadership. Investigative reporter Steve Wilson from WXYZ-TV, the ABC affiliate in Detroit, has followed Mayor Kilpatrick on trips across the country, forcing the mayor to admit he used city money to lease an SUV for his wife, among other stories. Other reporters have been critical of Wilson's gotcha brand of journalism, but they are equally critical of the mayor's response. The city's public access station is now airing a 12-minute attack video called Steve Wilson Inventive Reporter. It's quite a public spat, and Steve Wilson joins us on the line to talk about it. Steve, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you're an aggressive investigative reporter. You are not unused to spats in your career, but your thoughts on the video on you?
Well, before I get to my thoughts on the video, let me say my thoughts on journalism. To call what I do gotcha journalism, to say that I'm aggressive, really speaks more to what's happened to journalism in our lifetime than what's happened to me as an individual. I'm doing the same kind of reporting that I've always done. I think journalism has sort of left me. All I do is insist on an answer from public officials who, in my view, have an obligation to give one and not run and hide.
Well, your detractors say you ambush the mayor, you practically stalk him, you rent. Have you even gone so far as to book a seat next to him on a flight out of town?
Well, I think my detractors who make those claims have not been doing the kind of journalism that I think they ought to be doing either. Gotcha journalism, ambush journalism is not what I do. What I do is I call, I ask for an appointment, I say this is what I want to discuss, and when I'm told, I'm sorry, the mayor doesn't wish to discuss that, I go find him. If it means showing up at an event and asking a question unrelated to what the event was, because that's the only place I can find him, if it means buying a first-class airplane ticket to show the mayor spending that kind of money and traveling in that kind of style when this city's on the brink of receivership, that's what I do. I think it's a duty to do that.
Well, we've put a call into the mayor's office. We have not heard back, but according to reports, the mayor has accused you of setting up town officials from neighboring Warren. He says you traveled with them to Costa Rica, and then you paid for prostitutes so that the men would be seen consorting with the prostitutes for your report.
Well, that's totally untrue. And as far as me criticizing them for doing a critical piece about me, it's a little bit like a frog calling somebody ugly. And, you know, there are two problems here. Number one is how it's being done and where it's being done. It ought not, that kind of critical political hit piece to protect the sitting mayor in a tough reelection campaign ought never to happen on the government access cable channel. That's not why the FCC gives those channels and allows governments to use those channels. Secondly, it should never happen anywhere, anytime, where people just outright lie. What I don't do that they have done is include information that I know to be false, including, as you just pointed out, an example, a claim that I went to Costa Rica to hire prostitutes to set up public officials. That couldn't be farther from the truth.
Well, Steve Wilson, the mayor has gone on the radio in Detroit to apologize for several of the stories you uncovered, including leasing an expensive SUV for his family at city expense. Is that enough for you, or are you going to back off?
Well, I think the mayor has found religion when he sees his poll numbers, where he has about a two-thirds disapproval rating. I think that's what prompted the apology. I think the apology is really nothing more than a campaign strategy. We're not taking aim at the mayor. Our aim is simply to get the truth.
Steve Wilson, investigative reporter for WXYZ-TV in Detroit, Michigan. Steve, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
And as we said earlier, we called Mayor Kilpatrick's office for comment, but did not receive a response. Well, next week on Here and Now, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Philip Caputo's gripping new novel about the Civil War in Sudan is being compared to Graham Greene's The Quiet American. We'll talk to Phil Caputo about acts of faith. That's Monday. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Ballet dancing is not the kind of thing a tough kid from the streets of New York did in the 1940s, but that's what Jacques d'Amboise did, and it led him to international fame as a principal dancer at the New York City Ballet. Born Joseph Ahern in Massachusetts, he moved to Washington Heights in New York, took a stage name, and dropped out of high school to start a career that, at 71, still keeps him fast on his feet.
All together? Ready? 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, and 3. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. Left. 1, 2, and 3.
Jacques d'Amboise is now the unofficial ambassador for dance. In 1976, at the height of his career, he founded the National Dance Institute to introduce children to the arts through dance.
Albert Einstein, visionary, made a legendary discovery.
This weekend, d'Amboise is being honored by the Top Center for Dance Education here in Boston. On a visit this week, it took just a few minutes to get a group of kids dancing bigger and speaking four languages.
6 and 7 and go. Rumpa pumpa pumpa bida dumpa bida dumpa da. Rumpa da da rumpa dida. Keep going. Molto grazie, dancers.
I asked Jacques d'Amboise what it was like when he first started dancing.
I'd leave school, get on that subway, grab an apple and a nickel, right? And if I was held after school as a punishment, the whole class or anything, I'd miss that class. So my mother went to that principal and told him, if he's bad, punish him in a different way, but he cannot miss his ballet class. So after a few months or so, we were being punished again. Everybody had to stand up, face the back of the room. The bell had rang for dismissal, not our class, right? And then the nun announced, Jacques can leave for his ballet class, right? Hoping that it would, right, be a disaster. So coming out of the subway that night, right on the corner, Dave's Candy Store, my gang is waiting. What the hell is this dancing stuff, right? And I said, it's great. And I had my little practice bag, and I put it down on the sidewalk, and I said, there's this guy, Andrei Aglevsky. When he jumps, he floats. And there's a step called soprasol. And let me show you. You have to jump in the air, move sidewards, and land on the other side of this bag. And then I had everybody putting Coke bottles and trying to jump over him in fifth position, and right? And then by just saying that I was doing something so great and was proud of it, I had no problem. And then when I joined the company at 15, I would sneak my gang in to the city center so they could see me. And right? I was so proud and excited about it. And I was a good athlete on the block. And when I was a teenager, I could run out and jump over a car. I would literally run and jump over a car.
Really, you could?
Yes, I could jump over a car. Over an upright piano, I'd run and jump over the upright piano. And I wouldn't try it over a grand, only because if I missed it, I could really hurt it. But the upright I was sure of, because I could do it, it was, and they weren't that valuable. I was extremely energetic, and I could jump very high, and I loved to work. I always thought of each performance that I did as my first one and my last. And I would try to do, and I'd dedicate it to a teacher, and then I'd do my best. Then it would finish, and it would be over. And then I would think, now tomorrow I'll work to make this better. And the next day I'd say, now here's my first performance as a new, better dancer, because I worked all day on something. And so it was a constant enjoyment in the exploration of the possibilities that I had. So my life had been transformed through the arts. I can say hello and goodbye in 15 languages and count in those languages. I've pretty much danced and been to most places in the world, but all because of the arts. And I dropped out of high school.
Not to mention, I have to inject here, as someone who grew up in New York, I mean, there was a time when, I mean, I remember my heroes were, you know, Mantel, Maris, Jacques Demoise, big, big stuff. How do you get a kid as interested in dancing as they might be in baseball or football?
Well, first of all, people don't realize what dance is. For example, I'll ask you, what do you, Robin, in one sentence, give me a definition of dance?
Dance is when people move and they tell stories and express joy and other emotions.
Okay, now if listeners are listening to this and they'll all agree.
Say that's the wrong answer?
No, they'll agree with you. It's fun, they'll say. Or it's, oh, people, oh, well, you get moving. Or it's moving to music or something. Now, let's stop and really think what it is. If I was to stick out my hand to say hello to you, we would maybe pump it up and down twice or maybe three times, and that would be it. I wouldn't give you one quick little short shake and pull it back, because that would be a sign, a communication, that I don't like to hold your hand or I don't like you. I wouldn't grab your hand and pump it for half an hour, 10,000 times. There is a control of movement to communicate an idea or emotion. Shaking the hands is a dance. Every time we take pour a little wine in a glass and raise it and toast someone, we're doing a dance. It's an invention by the human being to express emotions by controlling the way we move in time and space. It's profound. The entire universe is expressing itself through the control of movement and time. It is so profound. And I think what makes us human is the sense of wonder that's expressed through our arts, the sense of wonder that's expressed in our science. How does it work? What is it? Isn't it wonderful? Isn't it, right? And play, the way we play. Everything is learned best in the world of play. I give you an example. Harry, put out the garbage. Oh, Mom, I'm too tired. Oh, do I have to? Harry, could you do something really interesting? Could you put out the garbage hopping on one leg and singing the Star-Spangled Banner at the same time. And by the way, you got to do it in 30 seconds. Yeah, I can do it. No, let me try. Right? You made a game of it. You made play of it. You made a test, a challenge.
You made movement of it.
And of course, you made movement. And you made theater, storytelling. See, everything is storytelling. Everything is a form of storytelling. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
Jacques Demboise, former principal dancer at the New York City Ballet, now the guiding light behind the National Dance Institute, which introduces children to the arts through dance. You're listening to Here and Now.
10, 11, 12, 13.
Jacques Demboise, it's so wonderful to sit here and, first of all, hear the New York in you still. See the elegance in the way you use your hand and just in just conversation. I'm just wondering, an older man now, do you find yourself feeling in your physical body what it must have felt like in the 40s and the 50s to be airborne, to be...
You see, there's one big trap that we have to get out of. I sold that house 5 years ago. I should have held on to it. Oh, if I had done this, oh, why did I marry her? Why, right? What a disaster to live in the past. We live now because we only control this second. The outside is hoped for. We plan for the future. We hope for it, but we have no control of it. We only control now. So when I see the roles and so many beautiful dancers dancing them and the music, and I think, oh, it's too fast or it should be slow. And I have to get that out of me because you can't live in the past. I can hardly, it's hard for me to step on a curb. Now, I'm different now. Would I want to be back there young? No. No, I am now what I am. If I was terminally ill with a terrible disease, I think I'd just go on a hike up to a mountain and keep hiking.
What is your connection with hiking? Because I read that when you reached, I think it was 50, you said, oh, great, I give up the ballet. I couldn't hike as much when I danced because I might get hurt. But now I can do my hiking. What's the attraction of hiking?
I love the outdoors. I grew up in New York City and Boston and New York, but every summer my mother would take us up to Maine, where all our French-Canadian relatives were. And it was just great to go in those woods. They were so mysterious and magical. And the wilderness, everybody has to have a foot in the wilderness and a foot in the marketplace. Because when you're alone in the wilderness, you realize the insignificance and the beauty and power of nature, and the need of fresh water and fresh air, the simple things. But you miss communication with people and the marketplace. And you yearn it. Boy, to get in those cold streams to wash was tough. Right? Sleeping on the ground was not. I usually don't sleep in a bed. I usually take a blanket and sleep on the floor all the time. Close to earth is wonderful.
Oh, Jacques Demboise, I could talk to you for another hour, but then those kids would not get to see you. So
Robin, thank you. You know, one wonderful way, by the way, listeners, meet somebody. Don't look at them at what they are now. Imagine what they were when they were 3 and 4 years old and 5 years old. You will love them. Look at the child in them, right?
Is that how you look at everyone?
I look at everybody. I look at you. I look at everybody like that. Yeah, it's wonderful. I love children. I like being around them because I look at them and I have become them. I become them, and I look at them and I think, if I'm them, what are they thinking? They're looking at me with my gray hair and my wrinkles and my energy. Are they scared? And I try, and then I think, you know, I say, are you married?
You know that song?
And it's a 4-year-old girl. You should see how cute they are when their eyes open up. They look shocked. 1, 2, 3, 6, 7, 8, 10, 11. 13, 14, 15.
Jacques Demboise, former New York City ballet dancer and founder of the National Dance Institute. By the way, his daughter, Charlotte Demboise, continues the family tradition dancing on Broadway. Jacques Demboise will be honored at a gala in Boston this weekend by the Topf Center for Dance Education. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Music comes after. I mean, vocal comes after. Albert Einstein.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
A 5, 6, 7, and 1. Da 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 bum, ba da 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 ba ba da dee da, da 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 bum bum ba 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 da da.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A House committee has approved a bill that would cut spending for public television and radio almost by half, moving those spending cuts further along the congressional pipeline. This comes as Kenneth Tomlinson, chair of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting System, has criticized PBS and NPR for what he calls biased programming. And it also comes as Tomlinson himself is being questioned for secretly investigating the program now when it was hosted by Bill Moyers. Well, joining us to talk about all things public TV and radio is Paul Fahrey of The Washington Post. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Robin.
And Stephen Labaton of The New York Times, who's also been covering this story. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome.
And Stephen, we want to start with you. What happened in the House yesterday? What exactly is being called for by the House Appropriations Committee?
Last night, the Appropriations Committee approved a spending measure that they're going to move to the full floor probably next week that cuts the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's budget by about 25% or $100 million, and then also has a host of other cuts affecting the infrastructure of public television and public radio, so the overall total would cut it about in half.
We understand that taking the biggest hits would be the technology.
That's correct. That's correct. But a fair amount as well would be hit by a lot of stations, particularly small, rural, and other stations that don't have as big a donor base as some of the larger city stations.
And we should say at this point that we are one of the larger city stations. We are hosted by WBUR here in Boston, and we get about 7% of our funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and we get 50% of our income from listeners. Mm-hmm. And, of course, of that 7%, we also have to use those monies to buy NPR programming. That's
right.
How the system works. Paul, we understand that the cuts came in things like buying digital programming or upgrading aging satellite technology.
That's right.
Is this an annual right for Congress to tinker like this, or is this unusual?
Oh, this is unusual. I mean, there have been attempts going back to the mid-90s to cut the public broadcasting budget, but this is the first wholesale whack at it the way they've done this. The thing we haven't mentioned is the cuts in grants that go to produce children's educational programming, which shows like Sesame Street and Arthur and such, that is has been cut, in fact eliminated from the public broadcasting budget. So this is a wholesale whacking of public broadcasting's funding.
But Steve, you write about an exchange in the House yesterday in which one of the legislators held up Bert and Ernie puppets as sort of a plea for their funding, but another pointed out there wasn't that much cut. What was that exchange?
Well, Representative Nita Lowey, a Democrat of New York, brought in Bert and Ernie puppets as a prop to try to highlight the issue, and one of the Republican lawmakers responded that that's not entirely fair or appropriate because, in fact, the Sesame Workshop, which produces Sesame Street, gets maybe 0.5% of its programming budget from Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is, in fact, accurate that they make so much money on licensing and elsewhere that they would not necessarily be devastated or harmed by it. But the reality is a lot of programming, and more particularly the stations, need the money in order to buy programming offered by National Public Radio or the Public Broadcasting Service.
Well, and looking at other issues in the public broadcasting world, Stephen, you wrote earlier this week about an investigation at CPB into payments that were made to Republican lobbyists, and including a payment that was signed personally by Kenneth Tomlinson, who's the head of the CPB, without telling the other board members. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. There were contracts with two Republican lobbyists one at the instruction of Ken Tomlinson and the other at the suggestion of his Republican predecessor, who's still on the board. The contract that we know he personally signed, or we're told he personally signed, involved that with a man in Indiana who was monitoring Bill Moyers' Now show and looking at the political leanings of his guests.
Right. And what has Mr. Tomlinson said about this, if anything?
He has not said that much about the Moyers contracts or about anything at all about the lobbyists. The Moyers contracts, he's acknowledged that he was doing to gather evidence to demonstrate what he has long believed and articulated, which is that the Bill Moyers show is a liberal show, and he's been very critical of it for almost since he's gotten on the board.
Well, Paul, you wrote earlier this week about PBS adding a new ombudsman to review these programs that have become controversial after they air, as well as to set new standards to ensure fairness in news. Is PBS reacting to Kenneth Tomlinson?
Well, they say they're not, but in fact they are. They're trying to buy some good PR and to show that they're being responsive to Ken Tomlinson and some of the Republican critics. They've appointed this ombudsman at the same time that the CPB has appointed two ombudsmen. So in addition to NPR having an ombudsman, it appears that ombudsman is the fastest-growing segment of the economy right now.
Mm-hmm.
They are really trying to show that they respond to critics and will put their own house in order so that somebody else doesn't have to do it for them.
But Steve, as you write, this has set up a weird catch-22 for public broadcasting because of perceptions of viewers and listeners.
Yes, a growing number of executives in public television and radio are very alarmed by the perception of a Republican takeover of the system, in some way alienating their traditional supporters. And the fear that they have is that that happens just as the critics are once again trying to take steps to cut the budget.
So given that the revenue stream might be shutting down from both sides, what's the future of public broadcasting? Weigh in, both of you.
I think the future of public broadcasting is very good. I think you're seeing a lot of things that may ultimately, and this is a big prediction, may ultimately turn out to be symbolic more than actual. The budget process has to go through the Senate. Public broadcasting has always had strong support in the Senate. It doesn't appear that the Senate is as disposed as the House is in terms of cutting the budget. That remains to be seen, but I think traditionally they've usually restored the money. Public broadcasting has survived in a world of 500 channels, 5,000 channels. It does some very good things. It has a very good, loyal audience. The people who support it are passionate about it. And I really don't see that the long term or even the media term is so deeply threatened. But they're taking these hits, and these are public relations hits as well as actual. It remains to be seen, though, whether or not they're going to be sustained.
That's Paul Fahrey of The Washington Post. Steve Labaton, in just a few seconds, your thoughts. Will these cuts actually go through?
The public broadcasting executives are, as Paul mentioned, are very heavily relying or hoping that their traditional allies in the Senate will restore them. Their biggest fear, though, is the concern as to whether the leadership, they continue to have support from the leadership of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting itself.
Stephen Labaton of The New York Times. We also spoke with Paul Fahrey of The Washington Post. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Kate Goldring, Joanna Broder, and Noah Susskind, whose proud parents are listening to make sure I pronounced it correctly. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.